Coming up on the Down East Journal, Fisher Houses offer toys, beds, and breathing space for military families adjusting to new lives. We explore Eastern North Carolina-based Fisher Houses. Camp Lejeune has one, and the newest one opened at Fort Bragg.
The families come in, and, you know, their face lights up, they're looking around, they can't believe that this gorgeous home is going to be this place that they're coming to stay.
Plus, Pokemon Go is causing a stir in Eastern North Carolina. We talked to community colleges about how they're handling an influx of people on campus, and city officials concerned about the safety of players.
We have had a few situations where we've had individuals at our fire station trying to get in to get Pokemon at our wastewater treatment plants as well as our electrical substations.
Plus, the latest garden journal.
With a little bit of planning, you can develop a garden that will attract a diverse population of butterflies.
Those stories and more just ahead. If you recognize that theme, you may be among the 75 million people playing Pokemon Go. The wildly popular app has young and old alike wandering around, phone in hand, searching for Pikachu, Charmander, and Squirtle. In an effort to cover this new craze, I set off to find Poke players and had no trouble at all. Wednesday evening, about a half dozen Pokemon Go players gathered on the corner of 5th and Evan Street in downtown Greenville. It's an area known to have an abundance of Pokemon. Some are camped out in shade near the Umbrella Market. Others, like Philip Madden from Pine Tops, are just passing through, hoping to catch a Pokemon.
This is pretty much the hot spot right here off of 5th Street. As I can see, there's a lot of people out, you know, just congregating across the street for that little festival over there. But then there's also people kind of walking through here for the game itself due to some of the hot spots.
Madden, who was out for a jog, has been using the app for entertainment and to get some exercise.
In the game, you get these eggs, which you can hatch into more Pokemon. And they're based off of kilometers. So 2Ks, 5Ks, and 10Ks. Basically, the higher the number, of course, the rarer the Pokemon. Not always the case. But so far, I've lost a few pounds doing this game. Just walking around, I've already gone over 120 kilometers.
Despite the intense heat, people are out and moving about in the downtown area.
Well, I'm going for a run and trying to catch some Pokemon at the same time.
For some, Pokemon Go is about competition. For others, it's social. For Carter Dodson, it's nostalgic.
Like, I used to play Pokemon back in the day. Didn't really think about it for about 10, 15 years, and then all of a sudden this game came back out and it brought back a lot of memories.
The free app uses GPS technology and your device's camera, and then it's up to you to catch them all. When you're close enough,
it'll pop up on your screen and you have to like click on it, and you just kind of use your Pokeball and you just like throw it. You have to swipe up and like try to catch it.
It sounds harmless enough, but Pokemon Go is causing issues here in Eastern North Carolina. On January 19th, Greenville police responded to an assault in the downtown area around midnight. 47-year-old Harry Ford of Burlington approached numerous people playing Pokemon Go. According to a news release, he reportedly initiated a physical confrontation before pulling out a knife and stabbing 19-year-old Dylan Manning. Manning was transported to Vidant Medical Center and later released. Ford was charged with one count assault with a deadly weapon and two counts of simple assault. Public Information Officer with Greenville Police, Kristen Hunter, said in an email that there doesn't appear to be any correlation between the game and the stabbing. Perhaps the incident just drives home the wisdom that nothing good happens after midnight.
The first weekend that Pokemon Go came out, between the hours of probably 10 p.m. and 5 a.m., we had over 200 people show up.
That's Security Chief at Coastal Carolina Community College in Jacksonville, Jared Pecora.
I've seen all types of people with their sons and daughters out here. I've seen couples out here on date night.
The campus on Western Boulevard is a popular spot for catching Pokemon because of the many Pokestops. These are real-world landmarks, such as monuments, statues, or historical markers, where Pokemon players can collect eggs, Pokeballs, and other items. Pecora says gameplay is allowed on campus during normal operating hours, though it's not encouraged. He says it's when people are showing up that's a problem.
I actually came in between the hours of 11 p.m. and 1 a.m. and I spoke face-to-face with about 45 to 50 people. And I do want to say that everybody that I've spoken to and met, they've all been very respectful. They've, you know, immediately done what we have requested them to do, which is, you know, to leave as soon as possible.
Word is getting out. Now, only about 15 to 20 people show up each night. A similar scenario was taking place at Craven Community College in New Bern.
And they come out 2, 3, sometimes 4 o'clock in the morning, and there's usually 2, 3, or 4 folks together as a little group.
I met campus security officer Sean Parker at one of the more popular Pokestops at CCC on Thursday afternoon. He says safety is a concern at night when the campus is closed.
We've had several folks come out here, but nowhere near a couple hundred. So far, I don't know if people haven't realized that the campus has a bunch of Pokestops and I guess a couple of the fighting arenas on campus, but we haven't had a large number of people coming out here yet.
Parker, who plays the game with his family, says people are welcome to hunt for Pokemon during daytime hours. CCC hasn't had any incidents so far, but security is urging players to pay attention to their surroundings when they're on the prowl for Poke characters. With the sudden widespread popularity of Pokemon Go, local municipalities are growing concerned about the safety of players in eastern North Carolina. On Wednesday, Rocky Mount issued a statement saying that they are requesting the removal of all city-owned addresses from the game. While there haven't been any incidents, officials want to take preventive measures to ensure the public's safety. Public Affairs Manager Tamika Norman.
We have had a few situations where we've had individuals at our fire station trying to get in to get Pokemon at our wastewater treatment plants as well as our electrical substations. So we first and foremost wanted to ensure citizen safety.
Due to public outcry, Norman says Rocky Mount is reconsidering letting people play the game at parks.
We are going to evaluate the areas which should be off limits for parks. We do want to make sure the public is aware of park hours, but we're going to look into that more closely.
About 134 city addresses are on the requested removal list. In New Bern, one of the most popular places to play Pokemon Go is at Union Point Park. Rachel, who didn't want to use the last name, is from Vanceboro. She got off work on Wednesday afternoon and met her friends to look for Pokemon.
Yeah, I've caught a Machoke down here, and there was a couple other things down here too that were big. We come down here pretty much every day and play with we got like a group of 9 people that we 10 people that we play with. So
it's 98 degrees at Union Point Park, but when it cools off in the evening, Rachel tells me it's not unusual to see a couple hundred people out here looking for Pokemon.
I knew that people were meeting each other and stuff like that too, so it's good that all these people are getting out and walking around and not staying inside. And yeah, we're on our phones and everything, but at least we're outside and we're exercising and stuff. But
Ian Robertson chimes in.
The only reason I'm out here, I don't even play it. I just come out here to watch them play and be outside and have a good time.
Yeah,
pretty much
we're
it.
We're an outside squad is what we do. We stay outside.
Pokemon Go players were up in arms this week when the city of New Bern cut off electricity to the gazebo at Union Point Park. Players were using electrical outlets to charge their phones, since the app is notorious for draining cell phone batteries. Some gamers feel the city is trying to prevent them from playing.
I mean, people are out here using their park. They shouldn't turn off the power.
That's what the park's here for, is for people to come out here and enjoy themselves.
You know, me personally, it's not like, you know, they're out here doing drugs or anything. They're out here playing Pokemon, and they're not sitting at the house. I think it's ridiculous, honestly.
Yeah, now I need to charge my phone.
New Bern Parks and Recreation Director Thurman Hardison says there's a misunderstanding that power was turned off to deter Pokemon Go players.
That's the furthest thing from the truth. We practice utility management at pretty much most of the year, and especially the outdoor utilities in our pavilions and our shelters, our gazebos.
Hardison says the electricity is usually turned off in the early part of the week to conserve power, and by Thursday afternoon, it's back on for the weekend when the gazebo receives the most use.
Again, that a bit misunderstanding about that. That was just a timing thing. I've told my staff if any of the gamers are out at Union Point Park or any other facility on a Friday afternoon, Saturday, whatnot, as long as they're not in conflict with a reservation with someone who is having an affair at one of the pavilions and there's power in the pavilions, they're welcome to it.
Now that the gazebo is getting more use from Pokemon Go players, I asked Hardison if he would consider leaving the power on for the whole week.
That's a possibility. Yeah, that's a distinct possibility.
However, I get the feeling he's more open to talking about coordinating special activities or events for Poke players at Union Point Park and making those amenities available then. If New Bern is considering holding a Pokemon event, they could take notes from the Farmville Police Department. On Sunday afternoon, they had their first ever Po-Po Pokemon event on the town commons and baseball fields. Chief of Police Donnie Green says about 40 to 50 people came out to the event.
Of course, it was 100 degrees outside, so We got a bunch of water together and some popsicles together, and everybody met. And I'm going to use Pokemon terms. I don't even know if I'm using them right. But people were setting out lures and stuff to try to attract Pokemon.
Green says the idea came about because several of their officers are playing the game. In addition to bringing the community together, he believes the event has improved stereotypes about police officers.
You know, I think oftentimes police officers are looked at as this hard-nosed, matter-of-fact, stiff person, and we're not. You know, we're human beings just like everybody else, and we would like to do some of the same things that everybody else does. And so I think that's exactly what it did. People were really shocked that there were police officers playing Pokemon, but we do, and well, they do. I don't.
Not yet.
Not yet. That's right. And it's funny, Jared, because our IT guy, I'm never doing it, and now he's doing it. And so now I'm getting sucked into that Pokemon craze.
And Green is not alone. Whether it's nostalgia or curiosity, more and more people, regardless of age, race, or occupation, are getting into the game. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. Since it opened its doors in April, Fort Bragg's newest house has welcomed more than 67 families. It's a special residence, part of the Fisher House Foundation's program, and the second such residence the Fayetteville Army Base has hosted in 23 years. It's one of two program homes in North Carolina. The other is at Camp Lejeune in Jacksonville. Chris Thomas has this.
How do you deal with a life permanently altered? By disease? A traumatic injury? Or the sudden, premature, and violent death of a loved one. Often, it's going about your daily routine.
My mom had, you know, her own little space, so she could get up in the morning and get her a little cup of coffee and sit outside and do her devotionals and all that.
Lori Sutherland of Fayetteville, mother of Michael Rodriguez, killed in action in 2007. Ms. Sutherland said he'd long dreamt of a soldier's life. When it came to an end over the battlefields in Iraq, her family, primarily from Galveston, Texas, was referred to the Fisher House at Fort Bragg. Nearly a decade later, Ms. Sutherland is now manager of the base's new Fisher House, the latest of 70. The former house, the house where her family stayed in the days following Specialist Rodriguez's death, is set to be demolished.
When they come to tear the house down, I'm going to get a window to keep. Just a little piece of the house. I'm going to have the guys that are tearing down the house to save me a window.
The Fisher House Foundation is a philanthropic organization started in 1990 by a Brooklyn-born builder, Zachary Fisher. Fisher Houses are residences built on military installations, usually near a hospital, and donated to the U.S. government. They are temporary living spaces for visiting families of service people wounded, sick, or killed in action. Its founding, according to Josie Callahan of the Camp Lejeune Fisher House, can be traced back to a conversation he had with Pauline Trost, wife of then Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Carlisle Trost.
And during the course of that friendship, Mrs. Trost brought to Zach's attention that there were these family members who are coming for their service member who was receiving treatment at the hospital and had no place to stay. They were staying in their cars. And he very simply said that he could build something for them because that was his line of work and that's what he could do.
Ms. Callahan has been manager of the Camp Lejeune Fisher House since it opened in 2010. She says she still remembers the first family that stayed there, a Marine Corps Master Sergeant, his wife, and their two children.
And it was so neat to see, and really, to be honest, it's so neat today to see the families come in and, you know, their face lights up, they're looking around, they can't believe that this gorgeous home is going to be this place that they're coming to stay.
Since its founding 6 years ago, the Camp Lejeune Fisher House has hosted 1,800 individuals for 5,600 nights. The house has 11 suites.
We have a family room, a dining room, kitchen, laundry room, business center, quiet room and unisex bathroom that our families share together. Those are our common area spaces. And then each family is given their own room and their own bathroom.
Tricia Leake, mother of specialist Drew Ruiz, who was diagnosed with cancer this past winter, was a guest of the Fisher House in Fort Bragg.
When we first got there, it was like coming home. I'd never felt so welcome in any place in my entire life. You were immediately brought in, treated like family.
She stayed from January to June and made the transition from the old house to the new. The old house, according to Ms. Sutherland, was roughly half the size of the current one.
There was a couple of times I had to get help as far as being able to provide food for myself, and that was immediately provided because there's so many volunteers that would come through there, and donations of food and pretty much everything that you would need to run a home.
Along with helping out around the house, Ms. Leek said she spent her free time exploring Fayetteville and contributing to the local economy. That's an under-examined aspect of a Fisher House's presence in a community, Ms. Callahan said.
So they're really no different than the folks who come in and stay in the hotels, except that they're not paying the occupancy tax affiliated with the hotels. But they're still needing to grocery shop, purchase clothing.
Though families usually arrive at the Fisher House under unpleasant circumstances, Ms. Callahan says some families will turn up while on vacation for a friendly visit.
One of our families had come, the last time they had come to us, their son had been hurt in Afghanistan. And so fast forward 2.5 years later, they were sitting in the rocking chairs on the front porch when I came into work one morning, and I said, "Hey guys, what are you doing here?" And they said, "He deployed today. He went back over, and we just wanted to see our friends that helped make that happen."
Some have been hesitant to donate to veteran-focused charities after multiple high-profile cases of alleged fraud were uncovered this year. But the Fisher House Foundation's record is, more or less, squeaky clean. They received the highest marks available from two major charity watchdogs, Charity Navigator and the American Institute of Philanthropy's Charity Watch database.
You know, we can't speak for any other organization, and we don't work for them. So they're responsible to their donors and to their boards and their folks for what they do, and we're responsible to ours. But we've kept that transparency there. So when people say to us, you know, what about these other things happening? You know, we can't speak to that, but let us show you what we've done, what we've raised, what we've done with it, how we're doing it, and what our future plans are, and let you make that decision. And I think by having all of that information available, and by time and time again doing exactly what we said we were going to do, we've been able to just keep that public trust, which is so important to us.
Like most charities, Fisher House Foundation takes donations, including hotel points, frequent flyer miles, and unwanted vehicles. But Lori Sutherland said the things individual houses need most aren't that different from what you may get at the store.
We need things like cleaning products, food, you know, groceries. Gift cards are always welcomed. That way we can run to the store and get what we need.
Items like new toys for the house's younger visitors are also welcomed. For more information, go to publicradioeast.org. I'm Chris Thomas.
Going to the beach is fun and relaxing, but it also can be a very dangerous place. This summer, there have been drownings, and one person is still missing along the North Carolina coast. On Monday afternoon, a father from Tennessee attempted to save his three daughters from a rip current. Someone in a passing boat was able to save the girls, but could not rescue 35-year-old Rick Brown before he lost consciousness at Shackelford Banks. There were also two drownings last week on Ocracoke Island and Frisco, and about 100 miles away at Wrightsville Beach, Coast Guard and local agencies called off a search of a man reported missing after going swimming Tuesday afternoon. Today, Mac McKee speaks with Atlantic Beach Fire Chief Adam Snyder about these powerful channels of water and how to break the grip of the rip.
What exactly is a rip current?
It's an area between two sandbars, which is a deeper area. When waves come in and they break over the sandbars, well, all that water, once it comes up and rolls up on the beach, it's got to go somewhere. So that water is actually funneled between two sandbars. And then, as you can imagine, it being deeper there, all that water is coming into one location, funneling out through between the sandbars at a very or higher rate of speed which we refer to as a rip current. Now, when it comes to a rip current itself, the strongest part of the pull is between those sandbars. What we refer to the head of the rip current is out past the sandbars, and that's where it actually the water starts dispersing in all directions, and you would actually feel the pull of the rip current get a lot less.
Now, does this initial pull, does it happen very suddenly and catch a swimmer by surprise?
No, it usually doesn't. A majority of times they're fixed rip currents, meaning that they could be there for maybe a full day or maybe for a weeks or even months. But now what does affect it that people get caught off guard is high and low tides. In between those tides, it can get the pull can get even worse.
Between high and low tide, which is the safest time to be in case you get into a rip current situation?
Well, what we like to say is right in between those tide changes is usually the worst.
Now, have you yourself ever been caught in a rip current?
I've been out in rip currents because we actually, fire departments or beach patrols, when we see a rip current, we'll actually go out and test that rip current and see how bad it's pulling for that day. We will mark those rip currents with red flags to make the public aware. And again, that's only going to be on our beach in Atlanta Beach, our main circle area beach that's guarded, which is 843 feet of beach.
Chief Snyder, when a person gets caught in a rip current, what is the first sensation they usually feel?
Well, the first thing is they notice that they are trying to swim to shore and they're not making any progress, or it's actually dragging them out further. And at that point, then they start swimming harder and harder and harder. Then they tire. And once they tire, then they start panicking. And then as soon as they start panicking, that's when they're having a hard time keeping their mouth or their head above water. And then they end up drowning. And again, if you're knowledgeable about what a rip current is and how to escape it, you would never have a problem. What we tell people is if you find yourself being pulled out or you start swimming ashore and you're not making any progress, swim parallel. Swim parallel, maybe 10, maybe 50 feet, you'll be able to stand up on the sandbar and you'll be safe.
In connection with the recent tragedy that happened this week at Shackelford Banks, you see somebody that could be struggling in a rip current, I'm sure your first impulse would be to go out there yourself and try to rescue them. But do you actually have a better solution to that?
In this situation here, any goodwill citizen is going to try to assist anyone that they can. This gentleman was the father of three daughters, of course, and the daughters were very young. They were in trouble. And me as a father, I would have done the same thing, swim out there to try to rescue my kids. The one thing that you should notice is if you do find someone in a rip current and they are in trouble, call 911 right away. Go ahead and get fire and rescue crews down there as soon as possible. The second thing is find someone on shore with some type of flotation device. It could be anything that will float, such as a cooler. Okay, coolers will float. Empty it out real quick, grab the cooler and go out there. Anything, boogie boards, surfboards, grab hold of and bring out there. In case you get in trouble yourself, you'll have a flotation device and wait for emergency crews to get there to help you.
Because if you try to do it without one, it seems like you risk tiring yourself out that much quicker.
Correct. Unfortunately, statistics show that the majority of people that die in rip currents are would-be rescuers, such as this case here.
Now, Chief Snyder, are there areas of the beach that are safer than others with a reduced risk of being caught in a rip current?
Well, yes, there is. On the case that we had this week in reference to the Tennessee family, they were on Shackelford Banks, and unfortunately, they were swimming. The girls got into the water and was swimming in the inlets. They are at the most western peak of the Shackelford Banks, which is a very, very dangerous location. They should have really never been swimming there. Along the beach and along the shores, the safest place for you to swim is on a lifeguarded beach. That's just the town of Atlanta Beach provides a lifeguard service during the summertime, so people can come down to the circle.
Now, how do folks find out if there's a high risk or low risk for a rip current that particular day or a couple of days? What should they look for?
News stations would be very proactive in reference to posting rip current threats in the morning time, such as weak, moderate, or strong possibility of rip currents. With that along is coming down to the beach itself. That is protected by lifeguards. You'll see a green flag, meaning that is great swimming. There's no likelihood of rip currents at all. A yellow flag meaning used caution that there is a possibility of rip currents. And red flags mean that we really don't suggest people to swim at all. We allow them usually to go up to about knee deep, but we advise them not to swim because the currents are so bad.
Well, Chief Snyder, thank you so much for being our guest today on the Downeast Journal.
Thank you.
This is Lisa Rayburn, horticulture agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of the Garden Journal. This week, I want to talk about butterflies. They add an element of moving beauty to the garden. North Carolina is home to more than 175 species of butterflies, making our state an ideal area for butterfly watching. With a little bit of planning, you can develop a garden that will attract a diverse population of butterflies. But before we get to the garden, I want to talk a little bit about life cycle. A butterfly's life begins as an egg, which is generally laid on the leaf of a specific host plant. Caterpillars are voracious, but very picky eaters. After a few weeks of feeding, the caterpillars molt into a mummy-like stage with a hard protective case that is called a pupa or a chrysalis. At the end of about 2 weeks, the adult emerges from the chrysalis, spreads and dries its wings, and begins searching for feed and a mate. Adult butterflies may not feed, or they will use a long proboscis, which is a straw-like mouthpart, to sip nectar from flowers. In this process, they serve as pollinators. In some cases, adult butterflies feed on rotten fruit or even tree sap. So, why do we care? This elaborate life cycle dictates that a successful butterfly garden will need to provide host plants for both the larvae as well as nectar plants or other food sources for the adults. Native plants are preferred for butterfly gardens because native plants are the plants that regional butterflies have adapted to and evolved with. Ornamental plants are bred for color and bloom size rather than nectar production. So while improved cultivars may be attractive to us, many of them provide little benefit to wildlife. You will want to choose a variety of nectar plants that will provide food throughout the growing season, since different species of butterfly are active at different times of the year. Choose flowers with blooms of different sizes and depths. Smaller butterflies have shorter mouthparts and are unable to reach the nectar in large blooms, while larger butterflies favor larger flowers. Most butterflies are active only in the sun, so many butterfly-friendly plants are also suited to sunny locations. Take this into consideration when selecting the location for your butterfly garden. Besides plants, there are other important considerations. Butterflies need shelter and overwintering areas. Most species survive the winter by hibernating as caterpillars, pupae, or adults. Very few butterflies migrate for the winter months. When possible, leave snags, standing dead trees, or brush piles in the landscape for overwintering. Throughout the growing season in fall, you'll want to leave dead flower heads and dead foliage on plants, or you may accidentally remove eggs or pupating butterflies. Another consideration is to provide a mud puddle or a damp sandy area for male butterflies to congregate around, as well as a few large flat rocks or a small area of dark pebbles for butterflies to perch on while basking in the sun. Fruit peels, cores, and rotten fruit can be placed in a discreet location in the garden where they will attract butterflies that prefer to eat rotting fruit. Another important consideration is to minimize the use of pesticides. Insecticides also kill butterflies and other beneficial insects. With a little bit of planning, you'll be ready to create a beautiful butterfly garden in your own backyard.
Thanks for listening to the Downeast Journal this week. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, drop us a line at publicradioeast.org.